Welcome to the Elements of Being podcast, where I dissect and explore the minds and habits of psychologists, filmmakers, writers, and industry icons. Essentially, we examine the mental and emotional narratives and processes that steer the social stream of consciousness. Truly, a chance to geek out over the psychology behind human behavior. Each episode is a glimpse into the trends and patterns of human behavior and the underlying influences that navigate us into different directions. Whether we primarily focus on nutrition or the unconscious, guests share insights, thought-provoking lessons, the nuances of creativity, and the elements of being us. Today, I'd like to introduce the very talented Dr. Sarah Lavelle, owner of New York Health Hypnosis and Integrative Therapy, and co-founder of the soon-to-be-launched mindful eating app, Bay Better Eating. It's practically a sin that we didn't discuss her current project in great detail, especially with my interest in our relationship to food and the psychology of our eating behaviors. Instead, we took a deep dive into the role of hypnosis in the clinical setting and the intriguing dynamics of marriages and conflict resolution, a fitting topic as everyone reflects on their relationships during the last 12 months of the pandemic. Clinical psychologist Dr. Lavelle is an expert in using hypnosis and integrative therapy for weight loss, eating disorders, anxiety, depression, infertility, and relationship issues. She also served as an adjunct professor at Brooklyn College and Adelphi University, where she taught psychology of sex and gender and psychology from a multicultural perspective. Dr. Lavelle's work with eating disorders has been highly recognized, with articles about her and her team appearing in Forbes, Prevention, Elle Magazine, New York Times, and New York Magazine. In our interview, we discuss hypnosis and the broader implications for one's inability to reach a hypnotic state, as well as its integrative role in the restoration of a failing marriage. We also dissect the fair expectations in the marriage dynamic, maladaptive patterns that lead to the most conflict and sustained tension, the idea of settling down, and the new relationship challenges experienced during the shelter-in periods of the pandemic. So with this being said, let's jump in. Dr. Lavelle, thanks for sharing the table with me today.
Thank you for having me.
This conversation about intimate relationships couldn't be more appropriate as we pull the shades on the pandemic era. The shelter-in, remote working and learning, and the limited time away from our homes has certainly challenged the routines of our day-to-day lives for better or worse. How do you manage a pandemic, nor how to manage your mental and emotional states when you triple the amount of time with your spouse, seems to be missing from the handbook on marriage. And I'm pleased to report that my wife hasn't banished me from our house after this 12-month stretch. Joking aside, relationships have met a level of tension, stress, and uncertainty never before seen, and many couples are struggling to interpret the experience and build a healthy foundation. Before we dig into the effects of the pandemic and discuss conflict resolution, I'd love to indulge in your specialty of hypnosis. What initially triggered an interest in this area?
It's an interesting question because I don't think I ever woke up and said, hey, I want to do hypnosis. What happened was I was in my mid-20s. I was about to start my PhD in clinical psychology, and I ended up doing this volunteer trip to Cambodia. And during this time, I got really involved in meditation. And I think, you know, when you travel like that, especially when you're young, you just become open to so many things. So when I got back from this month and a half trip in Southeast Asia, I thought, you know, I really want to do something that feels more holistic. In addition to starting this very esteemed clinical psychology program, I know that it's going to be just psychology. And it's going to be evidence-based, and there are going to be so many great things about it, but I've always been drawn to more complementary forms of medicine. So as I was reading and researching, you know, how to combine meditation into therapy or mindfulness into therapy, hypnosis kept coming up. And I remember thinking, well, that's weird. But the more I read about it, the more I was fascinated by it, because it really is just putting yourself into this meditative state that is an alternative way of healing, but it's really just using a group of psychological techniques. So it started with my interest in meditation, and then I really fell in love with all the techniques involved in hypnosis, because I see it as a lot more powerful for a lot of people.
It's interesting to align hypnosis with meditation, but I could certainly see the crossover, the alignment between the two. I could attest to the success of hypnosis. My grandfather quit smoking after decades of the habit following a session. My grandmother, on the other hand, continued to smoke despite the same effort. Are there broader implications for one's inability to reach a hypnotic state during one of your sessions?
So it's such an interesting question, because when you think of hypnotizability, people are really kind of talking about two things, right? One is, can you get into that state? And then the second is, are you going to take in the suggestions when you get into that state? So from my perspective, I've seen some people who don't seem like they're very deep, and they'll even say, I wasn't that deep. But they'll come out and say things like, oh, you know what? I don't even think I felt anything, but I did during that time just decide to never smoke again. Or I'll have people who say, wow, I felt so deep. And by everything that I'm looking at when I'm seeing them, like their body language, their breathing, they seem like they're in a deep state, yet they weren't ready to take on the suggestion. For me, I don't think in terms of hypnotizability, because I think it's just more about how much can a person let themselves daydream, as opposed to getting into some kind of specific state. However, I do think it has a lot more to do with, are you really ready to change? And the hypnosis is always going to be successful if a person is really ready to change, they just haven't summoned the strength yet, versus if they're coming in and saying something like, you know what, I don't really want to quit smoking, but my partner really wants me to. Go ahead and hypnotize me. You know, that's never going to work, because what you're doing through hypnosis is trying to summon, like you're trying to increase that person's internal strength and their own internal desire. And if the desire is not really there, there's nothing to really tap into.
I believe movies and books have mystified hypnosis in many ways, and you're certainly unraveling the psychological perspective related to this type of transformation, really pinning the mental emotional value of hypnosis. Besides belief in change, how does hypnosis enable you to understand the underlying dynamics that prevent change?
I want to say I love that question, because even the way you worded that question is the way we'd frame it in hypnosis. Opposed to traditional psychotherapy, which might say, oh, you're depressed or you're anxious, which I also agree with, you know, hypnosis would frame it in terms of what prevents you from being happy, what prevents you from being calm, right? What prevents you, you know, you've said you wanted to quit smoking for the last 10 years, what's preventing you from change, right? And hypnosis really is made to address that in the fact that it teaches you to use language to understand a person's ambivalence. And how you conceptualize and be in hypnosis in general is that, again, something specifically like smoking, it's such a tangible example. You both want to quit and you don't want to quit. So you'll say, I want to quit, I want to quit. And then you get that urge. And then you tell yourself you don't want to quit, right? So when you talk about understanding the dynamics that prevent change, you're really trying to use this language to get a person to not pay attention to that part of them that is afraid of change or doesn't want to or is somewhat blocked, and get them to only to focus on the fact that they want to do it. Right? There are a lot of reasons people can be blocked from change, right? If a person's not really ready and they say, I want you to get me to quit smoking, and I tell them, okay, smoking's bad for you, you need to quit smoking, I'm all of a sudden their parent, and I'm giving them something to rebel against. So if you think in terms of people are tend to be resistant because anytime you tell them to do something, their first reaction is, no, I don't want to, then you have to think, how can I change the language and say something like, well, what part of you wants to change? There's nothing really to resist in that example.
To bring our discussion back to our original intent, I wonder if hypnosis can play an integrative role in the restoration of a failing marriage. What have you witnessed in your sessions?
I find hypnosis to be extremely effective in helping a couple reconnect. It's not going to be the way people traditionally think of hypnosis. You can't hypnotize somebody to fall in love with each other again. However, people are really afraid to open up to their partners. people are afraid to say, for instance, forgive their partner for something they said, or forgive their partner for an affair. People are afraid to be vulnerable. For a marriage to work, both people have to be willing to say, I will change first. And if just one of them isn't willing to do that, it can't really work. But can you get a person into a state where they feel that love again and get them to actually realize how much they can open up and not be so afraid to be vulnerable and work towards actually accepting their partner using hypnosis? Those are the things that I think hypnosis can really address in a marriage that can be helpful.
No doubt. Before we step any further, I'd like to examine the dynamics of a marriage. Is there a perfect formula of personalities that leads to the most sustainability and satisfaction in a relationship?
Well, I don't know if there are certain variables that make it last, but there are definitely signs to look out for that would make it not last. You talk about John Gottman. He talks about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And he's really talking about what are the things that really cause marriages to dissolve. And he narrowed it down to four. And he would actually say that just observing a couple for a few minutes, he'd be able to predict whether or not they got divorced. The main one of those four that I'd want to address is resentment. Well, resentment and contempt. When you hear contempt for your partner, you don't feel loved. And when they hear contempt from you, they don't feel loved. And so if you can minimize these interactions that are triggering to your partner, instead of saying, you didn't wash the dishes, you're stupid, saying, I don't feel loved, or I feel taken advantage for when you don't do the dishes. So in thinking about hypnosis is the art of using language to minimize what would trigger that person, you could use those same techniques in your marriage. Think about, okay, well, what are these things that really trigger my partner? Can I dance around them to make sure that I don't hit their insecurities? And I think that in itself, knowing that you have a partner who's really devoted to trying to understand you, I think that does lead to a longer and stronger marriage.
Yeah, like most relationships, expectations play a significant role in communication. And what are fair expectations in the marriage dynamic?
Oh, that's a really good question. Well, what's fair? You know, I don't know if I think about what's fair, but what's healthy, right? What is healthy in a relationship is having one partner that you don't expect to fill any more than 40% of your emotional or social needs. It should be two different whole people coming into the relationship that want to be with each other and are dedicated to each other, but we don't expect them to solve us. We don't expect them to be the source that heals us. We don't expect them to complete us. We expect them to enjoy our company and for us to enjoy their company and to be motivated to get to know each other better and be motivated to try their best to understand us and that we try our best to understand them.
Yeah, it seems like a theme here is not looking at your partner as somebody that you're dependent on, but somebody that enhances your experience in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I often hear this idea of settling down in a relationship. And I think for some people, it's a negative, while others, it's a positive. And I see, as you think about this, some of those reasons why there's such a conflict in the interpretation there. And I wonder, how can a couple settle down in a relationship without finding too much complacency? Perhaps the most appropriate question here is, should we ever settle down? Maybe we should start with that.
Well, I guess I'd want to know more what you mean by settle down. Does that mean commit to one person?
I guess that's a fair question, right? We hear it so often. It's not something that's part of my language. I was just reflecting on what is most common for people. I assume that they're referring to the hustle of dating. And once you find somebody, now I can relax and be myself and slow life down and no longer try to win the partner. But of course, that can mean different things for other people.
Yeah. So when you talk about settling down, I guess the first thing I think about is Sternberg Triangle of Love. So it's the idea that for a relationship to be really a compassionate, like fulfilling relationship, you need three equal parts. One is friendship and liking, and the other is passion, you know, like passion, sex, intimacy, all those things. And then the third is commitment. And they would talk about if any of these get out of balance, it's kind of a different kind of relationship that isn't fulfilling. we can all think of probably examples that have two of them, but not the third. You know, there are people who could be passionate and like each other, but they're not committed. There could be people who are friends and committed, but there's no passion. I do think, you know, there is this sense of when we fall in love, it's infatuation. And it's a big projection onto our partners, but that's what gives us that butterfly feeling. And the more we get to know our partner, the less that butterfly feeling comes about in everyday life. But this kind of warm, overarching, I love you, we trust each other, we know each other feeling comes into place. And if you have that too long, it can feel a little bit like complacency. And so you need that newness every once in a while to kind of spark that infatuation feeling. Now, infatuation isn't meant to be extended, nor would it even be a good thing. You know, it wouldn't be good to feel infatuated with our partner for 40 years because it would mean we didn't know them. However, as we get to know our partner more and we have that commitment, you know, they take up a new hobby and that interests us and we do it too. The couple decides to move to a new location. You know, whenever there's change and a sense of unfamiliarity, it can spark those feelings of infatuation again. And I do think we need that every once in a while in a relationship, you know, dressing up for each other, date night. Those things that somehow make our partner feel like a stranger, yet at the same time, this person that we love and that we're committed to.
It just makes me think of our individual needs as well. That need for a newness or some type of change for brain stimulation. And we find that in different foods, different environments that we travel to. So of course, the broader implication there is that the couple in that dynamic would benefit from that newness or that change just as much. I also imagine that as we consider what some of these options are to avoid the complacency, we have to be mindful of the amount of tension or stress that might compile with that push outward. So I wonder, are there boundaries or things that we should keep in mind to not push or force too much outside of us while still respecting the foundation of the marriage?
Yeah, it can often be said that there are kind of three different parts of a relationship: you, the other, and the relationship. And the relationship kind of is its own thing. Now, that being said, we need to be able to read our partners. In almost all relationship, there's going to be one person that's a distancer and one's a pursuer. And the distancer feels engulfed if the partner needs too much from them, and they'll want to flee. But then fleeing is what triggers the person that wants the closeness, and they feel abandoned, right? So it's kind of checking with yourself and your partner, how much newness do we want? You know, you might have one person who's like, well, finally, we're settled. We're settled into a house. We're settled with our kids. We're settled with our friends. Why would we want to change anything? And that same sense of comfort could feel like a trap to the other partner. Like, oh, there's nothing new. There's nothing exciting. There's no change, right? And what happens is we generally find partners that we might think that we want to settle down consciously, but then we find ourselves choosing a partner that wants to mix things up a bit. And it's because we secretly want that. And the same thing, the partner who's always changing things, on some level, is gravitating towards that person to anchor them. So it's kind of evaluating how much can our relationship tolerate, and while keeping your own boundaries in place, being able to communicate those to your partner, right? Like, this is too much change for me. I want to be able to provide you that excitement, but it is making me feel anxious. Communicating those things is going to make that partner feel less trapped if they're looking for that excitement and that change, as opposed to just feeling like you're demanding that they settle down.
To pivot a little, you've quoted Healthline, if you're in a happy relationship, you have to take care of each other's hearts, and we don't just mean romantically. How can we take care of our partner's hearts, do you think?
I think the best thing to do is to ask them. I think everybody opens up when you hear your partner say, I want to take care of your heart. How can I do that? You know, people have these different love languages. So, you know, and you could even guide them. Say, does it feel like love to you when I do the dishes? Or does it feel like love to you when I rub your back? Or does it feel like love to you when I give you alone time to just watch TV without me, right? Like, we might assume that our partner experiences love the way that we do, but it's definitely not always the case. So the more we could prompt our partners to tell us, the more we can then try to bend to make sure that we take care of their hearts in the way that they want their heart taken care of.
Do you tend to prompt people to take the Languages of Love quiz online? I know it seems pretty popular.
Yeah, so, you know, it is pop psychology, but I find a lot of couples, they get some awareness out of it. You know, I wouldn't say that it would replace couples therapy, but in terms of deepening their love and understanding for each other, I think it could be a great bonding exercise. I think on top of that, you know, Gottman actually has love cards. They're free that you can download off the Apple Store. And they're the same kind of questions that kind of prompts these deeper conversations between you and your partners.
My wife and I, very early on during our dating phase, did take the quiz. And it was interesting to not only see her love languages and for her to recognize mine, but also to also understand the lens that she has with each answer of the question. So even if we had the same answer, we almost looked at it completely different. And that was incredibly valuable for us as a couple, understanding each other's intentions.
Absolutely. And then you find it's like getting a decoder ring. You're like, oh, I thought getting her flowers is going to make her feel loved, but maybe that actually doesn't. This thing does. And then you get that positive reinforcement after that.
Absolutely. Well, we're talking about love and taking care of our partner's hearts. So, of course, it's natural that we jump to conflict resolution. And I wonder, are there rules of engagement that all of us should keep in mind in our relationships?
I think the biggest thing is allowing yourself to be vulnerable with your partner, right? In many ways, I think the more we work on ourselves, the more we're aware of ourselves, and the more we can communicate to our partners, and then the less we're triggered. Our partner says something, and we haven't worked on ourselves, we often can misinterpret it and get explosive. So at the end of the day, isn't working on ourselves the best thing we can do for our partners?
And we have a lot to explore there, because then we really start to look at the individual within a relationship and their state of being and how it contributes to the whole. How can one's attachment issues, quote unquote, affect their role in a marriage?
Attachment affects roles quite a bit. You know, for those that don't really understand attachment, if you grow up with a secure base, you're going to see the world as a trustworthy place, and you're going to interact with people in a trustworthy manner. If somebody wasn't really tended to, you know, you can think in terms of their avoidant attachment, and then closeness feels uncomfortable to them. Or you have people who are insecurely attached, and they can kind of vacillate, and they could say, I love you, I hate you, I love you, I hate you, because they want so badly to be loved, but they're also secretly terrified. So they vacillate between wanting to pull the person in closer desperately and wanting to push them away.
Can you think of other maladaptive patterns that lead to the most conflict and sustained tension in a marriage?
You know, I really go back to that four horses of the apocalypse, you know, defensiveness, contempt, resentment. But also, you know, when people are blaming, you know, you'll see conflicts between people, I'm right and you're wrong, right? You'll see couples fighting for 20 years over who loads a dishwasher the right way. I think the more each couple could hold on to this idea that I feel grounded in my reality, but I also accept my partner's reality as equally as valid as mine, I think the better our relationship's going to be.
And we have to consider the lens that we employ within these interactions with our spouse, which couldn't be any more important. As you mentioned, resentment and other characteristics that we bring to the table are going to affect that interaction as a whole. How can we meet conflict with honesty and objectiveness without reaching those levels of shame and defensiveness on both sides?
So let me start with an example. Say a wife comes to a husband and says, you didn't take out the garbage. You're not cleaning the house. It's messy here and you're being careless. Most people are going to take that as an attack, and it's almost asking them not to listen to you because they're going to get defensive. When people feel attacked, they're going to defend themselves. So first, as the spouse in this scenario, if she can approach it in terms of I and how I'm feeling, and even take it a step further and say things like, you know, I know you didn't mean to make me feel this way, right? If she could say, you know, sometimes when you don't take out things, it makes me feel like you don't care about me. Or sometimes I'm hurt because I feel like I have all the burden. And I know you don't mean to do that, but I want to express to you how I'm feeling about it. That invokes a sense of that person wanting to respond positively, as opposed to them being provoked to respond defensively. Now, even further, say that same wife did actually come and say, you didn't do it again. You lied to me. You said you'd do it and you didn't. And they were angry. As a partner, yes, it'd be better if it started out in a better way, but we could also try to inquire more. at that time, when we feel attacked, before just responding defensively, we could sit there and think, okay, my partner is upset right now. Do I trust my partner to be a rational person? Well, I do. So there must be something going on, right? And before we explain why we didn't do it, we can start out by saying, you know, I'm sorry. I really didn't mean to make you feel that way. It's something I want to work on more. But let's kind of talk it through a little bit, right? So when we also then respond non-defensively, we open our partners up. So if the first partner, when they're upset, could respond in a feeling way, it starts out the dynamic better. But even if they don't, the other partner can still open that back up. But what happens otherwise, if you have two defensive people, then that person will throw it back and say, yeah, but you didn't do the dishes last week. And say, well, okay, yeah, but you didn't do this. And it could go on forever.
It reminds me of the responsibility of our reaction and to thoughtfully examine, you know, the message before taking a step forward. I often try to absorb the message and sit with it for a moment if I can without reacting. And if I do feel something stir up, to ask a question just to make sure that I'm comprehending what's being delivered. And sometimes that has circumvented a lot of arguments, because then you realize, oh, they didn't really intend for it to sound that way. Maybe they were under stress or tension from something else, and that energy was redirected or placed into the message that was presented to you. That is very difficult to do, and I can't say I'm necessarily perfect with that intent, but nevertheless, it's certainly a lesson for all of us before reacting and adding fuel to the fire of that conflict or conversation. Often when we identify stresses in a relationship, our partner may think that we're nitpicking the little things that they're doing. So how can we enhance our relationship and resolve some of these issues without the other person feeling it's a parent-child dynamic?
Well, when you really think about the stress in relationships, you know, obviously there's a number of things that cause stress in relationships. The common things would be things that are, you know, major life things. You know, people's cleanliness habits, how people parent, financial responsibility, these kind of big overarching things. But if you think about those, no two people are going to be exactly alike in their spending habits. No two people are going to be exactly alike in their cleaning habits. Even if it's two very neat people, one's going to be neater, which tends to trigger people into feeling like one is the responsible one who feels resentful that the other person's more careless. And then the other person feels like they could be belittled and that the other person's like this controlling parent that makes them feel like they can never do anything good enough. And so when thinking of those things, how are we recreating this kind of parent and child dynamic? And why have we chosen to be the parent or the child in one of those two things? Now, thinking about getting out of these things, if it's a kind of stress in the relationship that's really pretty toxic, you know, say somebody has a drug or alcohol problem, you know, that's something a person needs to address in therapy. And I think two people having a commitment to, if things are bigger than the two of us, we agree to therapy is going to be really important for any relationship.
As we talk about relationships, the pandemic has presented an interesting case study for us. What new challenges have you seen couples face the most during the shelter-in periods?
So, interestingly enough, you know, there's been a lot of trauma people have experienced and anxiety, but that's not really the thing that couples are coming in about. The biggest thing that's happened with the pandemic, you know, the pandemic is both, you know, a disease that threatens people, but it's also become very political. And even when couples feel pretty similarly about the pandemic, there's still going to be differences, right? You know, this person will say, hey, we want to make this exception, but just for my family. And the person will say, absolutely not. We can't make any exceptions. Or one person will think outdoor dining is okay where another person isn't. And then it gets into these weird complex with like, we could see these friends, but not these, this family, but not that. And that's probably been the most challenging thing I've seen couples have to face. Because again, it brings up that same dynamic we were just talking about. Who's the responsible one? And is the responsible one too rigid? Or who's the one who's like a child? Is that person irresponsible? Or is there some kind of a compromise? And what else I've seen more than anything is in this last year, couples are either getting stronger through all this, or they're actually realizing, you know, maybe I don't want to spend the rest of my life with this person. And in my mind, actually, either of those are probably better than just the status quo where people aren't very happy or they're just kind of complacent.
Yeah, the pandemic certainly has added layers of stress and uncertainty foreign to many intimate relationships over the last 12 months. And no doubt it tested the will of individuals and all of their relationships, especially with the things that you mentioned, the different responsiveness to a time of trauma, and also evaluating the spouse's adaptability. If a couple was truly interested in really pushing beyond, even though they are critical of each other and where they stand on the spectrum, what would be some of those first steps?
I think the first step with any conflict in a relationship is trying to remember why you love that person. Because it's interesting, what we generally fall in love with a person is tends to be the things we resent later. You know, we fall in love with somebody because they're so playful and lovable, and we really love that energy. And then later, we resent that, you know, they can't be serious enough. And we're, you know, or maybe we like those qualities, but being around them so much, trapped in a small space, is kind of driving us crazy, right? So I think there's a lot of evaluation that needs to go on. I mean, first of all, I do encourage couples to try to spend some time alone without their spouses as much as they possibly can, even if that's just going for a walk, right? Because we are in an unnatural situation that we're spending too little time with people outside of our immediate family and too much time with people inside of it. But then the other thing is trying to get creative. What can we creatively do that we both feel is safe? Because just as we were talking before, that like complacency, we do need this newness, and it makes it pretty hard to do things that are new. But maybe it actually causes a morph as well. Maybe you actually find as a couple this new activity that you like doing that you would have never thought about doing before the pandemic.
Yeah, you mentioned trauma again. Dealing with the pandemic or such a change has such an emotional effect on people, again, on a spectrum. And individual trauma is a topic that I've explored quite a bit on this podcast, but never really explored how a couple would effectively manage trauma or a negative major life event. What are your suggestions there?
So there is a lot about the pandemic that can be re-triggering for people. So for instance, I worked with somebody who, you know, had to flee their country as a young child, and this reminded of that. And all of a sudden they were having like panic attacks at night. You know, I do think this is a good time that if you're feeling anxious to dive a little deeper, whether it's through therapy or whatever that relates to you, I do recommend opening up to your partner. I have seen a lot of marriages getting a lot stronger during this time. And maybe there's something about this pandemic that's really shaken people to think, what is it that I want with my life? It's making people really reevaluate what's really important to them. And I think a partner could come along in that journey. If we are finding that there's a lot of stress in the relationship, you know, identifying it, is it just too much time in general? You know, and so is that easily solved? You know what, let's just take some time apart, like just as much as possible. Or is it something that you're starting to notice things about each other, right? Sometimes rough patches are good because they resolve something and it can feel hard, but once it's resolved, you really come a long way. And I think as people are getting out of the pandemic, their relationships are coming to a place that they're stronger.
Yeah, and that's a heck of a way to reframe it. I know for myself and my wife, we took the opportunity to really think about those things that were most important to us and what we loved the most and the things that perhaps were voids in our life. And really early on, my wife disclosed that she wanted to connect more to cooking in a way that she probably witnessed with her mother growing up. And myself, always in a self-improvement state of mind, also thought about what is my presence and approach to the world. And I know I'm not alone. I've met with a lot of people thinking about the same. But how do we navigate within a relationship when a spouse is pursuing personal growth and the other isn't, especially when it's outside of our interests and comfort zone?
Yeah, so that's the thing, is can we make the goal to be to learn to admire it? Because again, that one person growing is, that reminds us of when we first started dating. You know, like we were fascinated that they had different interests and hobbies than us. Right. And then we get stuck in this pattern where we expect each other to be the same when we're not. So I think it'd be kind of picking and choosing, well, what kind of things do we want to then take on with our partner? Because we could learn from them versus, well, what could we admire? Are there a lot of things that could make a partner feel left out if they're not doing it with them? There can be. But then maybe then you open up to your partner about why it's making you feel alone or why you feel left out. And maybe then they can come and say, yes, I have taken on this new activity without you, and I'm really enjoying it. But now that I know you're feeling this way, why don't we do a different activity together as well?
Yeah, I just think about one of the big steps that we took as a couple was to eat more plant-based meals. But I won't discount that that was more of an agenda on my part than my wife's. And she certainly has taken it on to incredible levels and makes things beyond what I've ever tried. And I couldn't be any more grateful. But I think what's worked in that dynamic, even though I have taken whole food plant-based eating to another level, perhaps greater than she has, is the respect of boundaries. So she has taken that step and a fairly big one that I recognize with me on that journey. I respect the boundary that she may eat differently at times. And we find a way, whether it's in a restaurant ordering food or being somewhere else socially, where we still pursue our individual interests and respecting, you know, the interests of the other person.
Yeah, I do think it's important that when one person grows, the other partner needs to be ready for it. Like even working in hypnotherapy, like I will tell people actually, we have a policy in our practice that we don't let a couple quit smoking at the same time because it needs to be both of their individual decisions. If it's like a mutual goal, sometimes it's just a half goal for each and you project onto the other person that, oh, this is their goal. And then you both say to each other, oh, well, I kind of feel like cheating. Oh, I kind of feel like cheating too. You know, and then both people are smoking again. Something like changing your diet in a dramatic way. You know, it's important that you kind of both check in with each other and yourselves so that you make sure that now it's one thing to be curious about the change because your partner's doing it and wanting to go along with it to see if it works for you. But it'd be another to have a diet that you feel like isn't quite right for you just to make your partner happy. And if you do have these different diets, can you two tolerate it? You know, I think tolerating change between the two of you or tolerating difference is actually a beautiful thing in a marriage, right? And not feeling like you have to be the exact same in order to coexist and be happy with each other.
We've discussed so much about relationships, and there's quite a bit for us to think about here. Thank you for discussing a topic on the minds of many. I mean, let's be honest, relationships, the drama that often ensues, it's really the foundation and root of a lot of the television, movies, and things that people talk about. And thank you for bringing such objectivity and sense to something that's so important to all of us. Your insight and contribution to the world can be more appreciated. So cheers to better relationships, and I hope you will be well as you step through the rest of 2021.
Thank you for having me.
If you find this podcast interesting, there are many ways you can support it. You can review the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen on. You can share it on social media with your friends. You can blog about it or discuss it on your own podcast. Or you can read the show notes on michaelmoodyfitness.com. Thank you for supporting the show. Listeners like you make it worthwhile.